Thank you very much, Rabbi Wallerstein. And, good evening, everybody. It's really remarkable that Rabbi Wallerstein was not supposed to introduce me. This is not going to work. But it's as if he read my mind. No, we'll see how that connects in a few moments. The title of the talk is Empower Your Future to Protect Their Future. It was a bit vague. So I decided to talk about what I thought were some of the underlying issues that lead to these things instead of just the usual abuse prevention stuff that I've done here a number of times. But you heard a little bit about what Amudim does and why Amudim is here. And in a very similar way, sadly, I want to tell you a little bit about what led me to become a mental health professional. I was in my early 20s, a Beis Medrash guy, in yeshiva that had an affiliated high school for at-risk youth. And informally, the Beis Medrash guys were sort of set up with as chavrusas or mentors for these high school kids. I was set up with one fellow in particular. He was high 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. He woke up in the morning, the first thing he did was get high. Before he went to bed, he made sure to get high. That was the presenting issue. Underneath it was more complex. In one of the few lucid conversations I ever had with him, he shared with me that despite being an exceptional Talmud in his yeshiva, having memorized vast amounts of Torah Shebaal Peh by and kemat all of Torah Shebiksav, Baal Peh, he still felt like a failure, a disappointment, excuse me, particularly to his father. He was a very critical man. And his mother stood by. In that conversation, he said some haunting words to me. He said, sometimes you push a child, and eventually you push too far, and they go over the edge. For a while, what did I know? I had no training, no background, no nothing. I would go try to be a positive influence in his life, sometimes sit in his dorm, near his dorm bed, just listen to music with him, show him that somebody cared, somebody had some concern as to his well-being. Occasional conversation. There were some signs of improvement, some motivation. At one point, he attempted to keep Shabbos. He would smoke so much Erev Shabbos so that he would be able to sleep 25 hours straight, so as not to have to wake up and smoke on Shabbos. But ultimately, it was way too little, too late. And on one fateful day, the call came into the yeshiva that he had died of a drug overdose. And everybody was up in arms. What a tragedy. Everyone had brilliant ideas, what to do, what should be happening, what could we do? Quite frankly, I was furious. Now everybody's up in arms. Now there is, in fact, a huge tragedy, and it is a tragic, tragic thing when somebody dies at such an early age. But this tragedy didn't take place on that day. This tragedy was years and years and years in the making, and it was plain for everybody to see. This addiction was not hidden. And even the pain that he was using the addiction to cover was not very well hidden. Too little, too late. It was one of the things, amongst many factors, that led me to realize that there was a desperate need for highly trained mental health professionals in the Frum community. And it's very similar to cancer. The underlying reasons for this guy's death on the death certificate It says drug overdose. But this guy didn't really die of a drug overdose. He died of what, in the modern research, is called shame. What is shame? It's feeling unworthy, unlovable, feeling that if people really knew who I really am, they would disconnect themselves from me. They would not approve of me. Like cancer, sometimes in order to treat the cancer, you have to wipe out the immune system. And then you can be very susceptible to a virus, a pneumonia that actually kills you. Shame was his cancer. Drugs, his treatment. But sometimes the treatment kills. Shame is very different than guilt, as described by Brené Brown. And if you haven't watched any of her TED Talks, one called The Power of Vulnerability, two, Listening to Shame, they're incredibly worthwhile. She distinguishes between guilt, which is action-focused. I made a mistake. I did something wrong. From shame, which is person-focused. I'm not good enough. I'm a mistake. Shame, highly correlated with addiction, depression, aggression, violence, eating disorders, and suicide. Guilt, the ability to hold oneself up to a standard, I could have done better, I made a mistake, inversely correlated with those things, highly adaptive. What's really important to know, even quote-unquote successful people can be plagued by toxic shame, as evidenced by two of my patients. And shame is really at the core of perfectionism. Two of these patients, one, a real estate mogul, incredibly wealthy, incredibly talented at being able to assess a property and how you're going to develop it and extract value and then manage it. But also a very critical father and a mother who felt it was her duty to stand by her husband no matter what he did, as they watch the decimation of a family. So while on the outside he's incredibly tough, can negotiate deals like you can't believe, internally he's plagued by shame, always afraid people are out to get him, they don't really care about him, they're always trying to mess him over. So he erects an enormous bunker around him, which is highly efficient at keeping him from feeling the pain of that rejection. There's just one problem with that bunker. He's the only one in it. So it's incredibly lonely. His wife, from an incredibly wealthy family, highly put together, geschickt, very good looking, but also filled with shame. So she cannot be vulnerable to her husband and request the love and affection she needs. So she pokes him, she prods him, she nags at him, seeking his attention and affection without being able to be vulnerable enough to ask for it. So he feels hurt. The barrier gets bigger. He built a $5 million home, thousands and thousands of square feet. Yet he asks her, "Do I have to build one behind it so we'll have enough space for you to leave me alone?" To my other patient, a Rosh Yeshiva, one of the best Talmidim in his yeshiva, now gives shiurim to both Beis Medrash guys and Balabatim alike, beloved by all. Grew up in a very aloof house, parents not really much to do with him, no real interest in his emotional well-being, making him incredibly vulnerable. And eventually somebody took advantage of that vulnerability and abused him at a young age. And he didn't feel he had anywhere to turn, so he harbored that inside for decades, till he finally couldn't hold out anymore and came to therapy. But despite all the accolades and everyone telling him how amazing he is and how much they love his shiurim and how inspiring he is, he feels like a fraud. "I don't really have enough Yerushimayim. I'm not as big a London as they think. I don't really love learning as much as they think I do. They could do much better by a bigger Talmud Chacham." Constantly beating himself up. never good enough. So, what happens? We create children that are vulnerable. Then, abusers love to take advantage of that vulnerability. They're probably the best assessment tool we have. They're incredibly able to pick up who are the vulnerable kids. Then they abuse those children. And if you thought you had shame beforehand, now it grows exponentially. And where do you turn? It just exacerbates everything. Similar to the addiction. You're incredibly shame-bound. You try to escape that, so you take drugs. When you sober up, you say, oh, I'm a druggie. And you feel even worse, so you need even more. And you can enter the death spiral we've been talking about. So many people turn to the age-old ways of getting out of those feelings of inadequacy. Fame, fortune, and power. If I could hold on to something, look, I own those buildings, look at my net worth, I matter, everyone will listen to me, maybe those feelings will go away. As Eric Fromm describes it, trying to focus on having rather than being. But there's a new age way to deal with such pain, and that is the internet. On social media, I can get the illusion that thousands of people are my friends, that they're interested in the minutiae of my life. And even more directly, with pornography. Any negative feeling I have, as long as I can enter the illusionary world that the pornographers depict, so I'm feeling unloved, they have a solution for that, someone who's incredibly loving on the other end. If I feel nobody's really happy with me, I can't please anybody, somebody will be incredibly pleased on the other end. And even if I feel out of control and desperately need control, I can find a depiction of that as well. But if I feel guilty, oh, I'm hurting somebody, oh, they enjoyed it too. So now I'm in full control and they're happy about it. So I don't have any more guilt or shame. But the moment the illusion is up, it's all back again and you need more and more and more of it. And it's becoming ubiquitous at this point. So what contributes to shame? And what I'm about to say does not come along with any judgment. In fact, I'm keenly aware of how difficult having good shalom bias and parenting like Revelia talked about is. And the worst thing that you could leave with here tonight is to feel ashamed of your own parenting. Because probably the lead contributor is actually parental shame, not feeling good enough. And that gets transmitted in a very bad shalshelas hadoris. And as it is, our children are often representations of us and very attached to our ego. But certainly if I'm filled with shame, then I really am affected by how my child looks and what they say. Are they chutzpedik? Are they going to be great talmidim and talmidos? They're highly attached to my ego. And so everything becomes very personal and very sensitive. Oftentimes, we just simply make many developmentally inappropriate expectations. So we expect three-year-olds to be able to control themselves and not have angry outbursts, or to clean up after themselves, or for kids to sit at the Shabbos table, or not even to be mechutzafim, which quite frankly is often developmentally inappropriate, especially when they're having emotional difficulties. Oftentimes, we're very short-sighted. So if you ask almost any parent, what are their long-term goals for their children? They'll say they want them to be well-rounded, assertive, self-motivated, happy, healthy, and well-balanced. But yet so often, we just want their compliance in the moment. Just finish your homework so I can give you supper and you can go to bed and I can have a few minutes of menuchas ha-nefesh. And we exchange that short term for the long term. And does that compliance, many times afterwards, we think to ourselves what the rationale is. The truth be told, I found this personally, it was a little shocking to me. So much of the time I say we don't even enter the chinuch processor, our seichel. We just have an emotional reaction, and then we make up terutzim afterwards as to why we did it. Very infrequently, they're actually thinking, is this thing going to be in the best interest of the long-term chinuch of this child? So we gain compliance, and we rationalize it that we're teaching moral behavior. How often are we actually teaching moral behavior? So if my child loses his or her toy because of an act, or they get a timeout, have they learned anything moral? Even worse, if they will feel bad about themselves, have they learned anything moral? Did they actually learn a respect for a human being themselves, and then an interpersonal respect for another? Or did they learn, this causes me pain, so it's not worth doing under these conditions? Unfortunately, the kind of shame we're talking about, wherever that is found, wherever there is shame like that, there is a shamer. And we learn to be ashamed of ourselves from those we're most closest to and most dependent on. Parents, educators, authority figures. The more significance in our lives, the more deeply entrenched it gets. Most children can't distinguish between their impulses, their actions, and themselves. So when we're very harsh on their impulses and their actions, they take it as negativity about themselves. And in general, though we've come a long way in the last few decades, there's still a tremendous lack of respect for children. They're sort of second-class citizens at best. Oftentimes, we actually attempt to shame them to get them to comply. Big boys don't cry. How often do we hear bad boy or good girl? Even about babies. Is it a good baby or a bad baby? How many times in my office will I hear this child is so lazy, or lies, or is manipulative? Now, even if we don't say those words directly to the children, but we're walking around with those beliefs, they will pick up on them. And unfortunately, shaming is very common. And it's, in many situations, considered acceptable. And it's not restricted to the abusive families. In fact, it occurs in the, quote-unquote, the nicest and firmest of families. A study out of Canada found that only 4% of school-aged children had not been the targets of their parents shaming, rejecting, demeaning, criticizing in a destructive way, or insulting statements. About 30 years ago, there began a self-esteem movement. And that was very helpful in the sense that children today are a bit happier and a bit more motivated, but in many other respects, in terms of their functioning and in terms of their overall mental health and other areas, it's been sorely lacking. And what I believe has occurred based on a lot of the research is that people went the other extreme and they said we have to coddle children and praise them excessively. So there's no more winner or loser. Everybody gets a trophy. You look at their picture, you say, wow, you're a Picasso. But that doesn't really ground them in the reality. Because eventually they're going to figure out, no, there's a kid on that ball field who can crush the ball much better than you. There's somebody who can draw much better than you. There's somebody in your class who's smarter than you, who's prettier than you. And then what do they have? And they collapse under the face of that. So excessive praise from the outside doesn't help them deal with the reality of themselves. That raises the question, so what does work to raise secure, wholehearted, and resilient children? So I want to go back to an incident in history, something that's not so well known. In 1945, there was a Battle of Okinawa. It's an incident in history that's largely overlooked because after it came the Battle of Iwo Jima, the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, eventually the Germans giving up. But at the time, Okinawa was an island 350 miles off mainland Japan. And both the Americans and the Japanese knew that if the Americans captured Okinawa, it would just be a little hop, skip, and jump through air attacks and sea attacks to capture mainland Japan. And the Japanese had a different philosophy in battle. You did not come home. You left it all on the battlefield. So it was an incredibly gruesome battle. At that point, 550,000 troops were in the Pacific. On the island of Okinawa, 250,000 people died. One out of every three people on that island died. So just imagine you have 3 to 6 people on your bench. If this was the Battle of Okinawa, one or two of those people would have been dead. And of the remaining survivors, a third to a half were wounded. So when the Americans finally went on to Okinawa, they sent in a bunch of mental health specialists, expecting that the mental health carnage would be as bad as the physical devastation, where almost all the crops were obliterated, every family was crushed. They found something incredible. The Okinawans were largely intact. This was astounding to them. And they began to study what was going on in Okinawa. And what they found was that Okinawan children were well-mothered. They were given the breast at will until age 2. The parents were deeply focused on not allowing early frustrations in the child and would breastfeed the child whenever they experienced that frustration. They attempted to minimize that as much as possible, and the mother spent a great deal of time with the children until age 5. Also, they had a tremendous understanding of child development. So if a child in Okinawa broke something, his mother would scold herself for leaving it in a way where the child could access it. They also had a profound respect for and autonomy for the children, so that a Navy photographer asked an Okinawan father and his very young child, "Can I take a picture of you?" And the father said, "I can only give you permission for myself. You have to ask my very young child for permission prior to taking a photo of him." And this was very similar to what today is called attachment parenting, being incredibly sensitive to the developmental needs and emotional needs of the children. In very simplistic terms, the Torah perspective on this. When Reb Chaim Kanievsky was asked by a bunch of mechanchim, what should they tell parents in terms of educating children? Not usually a man of many words. He said, "Tagid lahorim dvorim pshutim." Tell the parents very simple things, things that should not have to be spelled out, but today overwhelmingly need to be. Shigam biyachas liyilodim yesh bein odom lechaveroi. Also, when it comes to children, all the halachos of bein odom lechaveroi apply. V'she'ein mechila al zeh. There's no forgiveness on this. And he said, with an adult relationship, before you go and criticize somebody, a colleague, a worker, how many times do you think about how to say it, what you'll say it, when the best time is? He said, so too with a child. They asked him, if so, how can anyone be a parent? It's terrifying, we'll be oiver. He said, if you are very respectful and if you do your best, then there's harbe rachamim in Hashemayim. Under those situations, Hashem will take care of you. Maybe what's most crucial in terms of parenting is our own ability to have self-acceptance and compassion. It's the non-edited art scroll book that we all struggle, that we're not malachim, that Hashem put us here as humans with enormous failings, enormous things to work on, nothing we have to be ashamed of. It's part and parcel of the human condition. Struggle is integral to normal life. Parents need to model that self-compassion. Instead of saying, oh, I'm so stupid, or I look fat. What do the children hear in terms of your own ability to have self-compassion? And maybe integral words from a book called The Power of Empathy. Instead of, I'm okay and you're okay, which is often how we try to present ourselves, a different philosophy. I'm not okay, and you're not okay, and that's okay. We don't have to be perfect. We don't have to pretend to be perfect. In general, we need a lot more vulnerability to be more open about our struggles with our friends, with our spouses, and with our children. They're experiencing our imperfections anyway. We might as well use it as an educational vehicle to teach them how to embrace our humanness. And what we find in the research is those who live wholeheartedly, who see themselves as worthy of love and connection and have wonderful relationships, they view vulnerability as integral to that. They have the sense that even with your struggle, you're still worthy of that love and connection. And it's fascinating. There's only one factor that really distinguishes that group from the group of people who struggle all the time. Am I good enough? When will I be good enough? Will they like me? And that is, do they feel worthy of love and connection? That's the only factor. So we need a lot more empathy all around. And what is empathy? In contrast to sympathy, sympathy is I take my experience and cut and paste it. So you say, oh, I have a sick child. I have a sick child as well. I cut and paste my experience onto yours, which is somewhat helpful, at least you're not alone. But you lose the uniqueness of your own experience. No matter what, even if you're going through the exact same event, every person has a different experience. And I lose that. And maybe the best example of empathy I've ever seen is actually a Rebbe Shemaisa. So the Rebbe Maharash would sit with people for hours on end, and he would perspire profusely to the point that during certain visits he would have to excuse himself to change his clothing. So when he was asked, what is pshat that you're sweating so much that you have to change your clothes, he said the following. When people come to me, they're wearing their garments. When they express their problem to me, in order for me to understand it, I have to get out of mine and don theirs. Then once I understand their issue from their perspective, I have to think about whether it's the divrei chizik or the advice through my own seichel, my own perspective. So I have to get out of their clothes and put mine back on. Now that I've come to that place, I have to give it to them in a way that they could understand through their experience. So I have to get back out of my clothes and put on theirs. He says, now do you wonder why I sweat? Such is the art of listening. Such is empathy. And we lack so much empathy in the world. We're so quick to judge. I'm better, you're worse, I'm right, you're wrong. The ability to share and to really hear another person's perspective, especially seeing the world through the children's eyes, putting aside our expectations and our thoughts and trying to see what is it that they're seeing, that is crucial. And really, empathy is the antidote to shame. Shame really needs silence and secrecy to grow and thrive. But when you're really ready to be vulnerable and courageous enough to put your true self out there with all your failings, and let another person see you, often that's very healing. Because truly, who's usually the biggest critic? Ourselves. And when we share with others in a real way, it starts to douse the shame. And truly, this is the best way to prevent shame in the beginning. Because if you grow up in an empathic environment, you realize your thoughts and feelings are valid, are meaningful, can be understood and respected. So you don't even get shamed to begin with. We need to know that sexuality is one of the most shame-prone places. I have yet to have anybody come to my office with neurotic symptoms because they speak Lashon Hara. Despite the Chofetz Chaim enumerating 37 lavim and describing that the Beis HaMikdash is not being rebuilt because of Lashon Hara, I have yet to have one. But I can open up a practice dedicated just to issues around sexual fantasy and masturbation and the shame associated with it, let alone abuse situations. So we need to talk to kids about sexuality. We need to normalize the drives and the struggles and to prepare them for the exposure and what they'll encounter. I don't know too many people who made it to the Chassan and Kala speech before they knew. So they're getting it somewhere. Not usually the healthiest of places. And today, we used to look it up in the dictionary. If you look it up in Google, you're going to get an education that's going to scar you. And even if your friend has that education and shares it with you, it'll be very problematic. We need to be proactive about this. I know it's uncomfortable. But trust me, if you stood on my phone line for one day, you'd be cured of that discomfort, I assure you. And it's crucial to know, even if you have a great relationship with your kids, they pick up, this is an area of no-go. We don't talk about this. This is shame. So we need to take the steps and initiate it. And what the research shows is not what most parents think, oh my gosh, if I open this up, who knows what they'll end up doing, increase their curiosity, increase their acting out. The research demonstrates the exact opposite. That children who have gotten this education are less likely to go pursuing this information elsewhere and less likely to act out inappropriately. It does not give them permission to do anything. It's actually an opportunity for us to teach the Torah values around it. Another difficult issue, like I said before, parental shame is often the primary source of shame in the children. And it's crucial that parents get their own therapy if needed. Many times you're trying to hide it and you'll try to perfect your children, and that desire will just go on and on and on. So often, they'll drop the kids off by me, but I can only take the kids so far unless the parents are really willing to do the hard work. And the same thing, sometimes it's a spouse. And you think, God, I can't really say it, I can't do it, and you stand by and watch that decimation unfold. And it can be a very difficult period. If it's that case, you need to help the spouse get into therapy. And if it's a marital issue, don't think, oh, we fight only in private. The kids always pick it up. There's a marital issue, you need to get the marital therapy. And obviously, like Revelio talked about, if your children are symptomatic, get them help early. The research shows that most issues take between 8 and 23 years from symptom onset till somebody sees a mental health professional. By the time I get them, the issues are so deeply entrenched, they're incredibly hard to deal with. Things could be so much easier if they're dealt with sooner. One of the greatest paradoxes in our society is the paradox of shidduchim. So in trying to do well for our kids, and we put pressure on them, we make them look good on the outside while suffering on the inside, and then when they're really struggling, we don't get them help out of fear that it's going to mess up their shidduchim. We view it almost as if the shidduch is the finish line. I hate to break it to you. It's nowhere near the finish line, because I get the calls afterwards. And then if they're not healthy beforehand and now they're married, the issues are just twice as great. And if you put children in the mix, they're exponentially greater. So we need to do this beforehand. And now research only from the front community by Yitzi Schechter and the ARC Institute has found that abuse victims are 6 times more likely to divorce than non-abuse victims. So we need to address this. And it's the greatest paradox. I don't know of a place that there's more talk of emunah. Basheret, 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 koshiz, yivugin, kikriyas, yamsiz, basko. And there's actually less emunah. If I do the right thing, if I'm vulnerable, if I share my experience, if I get help, they're going to mess up the shidduchim. No, if you do the right thing, Hashem will get your child the right shidduch. Somewhere on my talk, there's supposed to be something about advocacy. So I'll just say the following. Sometimes it's very difficult. There is a philosophy that parents have to have a united front. But if you have one very unhealthy parent, why should children lose both? At least they should have one. And sometimes that means not standing by. So many of the people in my office were tormented by one parent and have such kindness on the other because where were you? How did you just sit there and watch? It can be very challenging. It needs a lot of sophistication as to how to work that through. But we need to really advocate for our children. Similarly, regarding school settings and between peer and peer, kids can get bullied, kids can be ashamed in many different settings. And I'm not encouraging people to go in there every time a teacher said something to go in there and bust it up. We have to collaborate with our schools. And the yeshivas here, we've worked with them, we've collaborated with them on very difficult areas. They are ready to collaborate. But you've got to advocate for your child. There's nobody who's going to be the advocate for your child. Not even myself or Tzigua. You got to be the primary. But I want to end with something very encouraging. And that is that through all our efforts, focusing on self-esteem, how many different educational workshops for parents, for teachers, the tide has changed enormously over the last 30 years. And yes, our children are doing better in many respects. And even in the area of sexual abuse, though we're hearing about it much more and there's much more awareness, what we found is that there is a steady and significant decline over the last 30 years in the actual incidence of abuse. So while we're making noise, and we need to make noise about it, because otherwise it doesn't go away, it is actually slowly but surely getting better. And it's crucial to note that the overwhelming majority of abuse survivors, with the right help, go on to lead happy, healthy, and productive lives. And I'd like to end with another story from my practice. I'll call this young boy Yanti. A couple of years ago, the person who handles most of the abuse cases for Relief, that does a tremendous amount of mental health referrals in the firm world, called me, and he was visibly shaken. He said to me, "Shlomi, I have one that I need you to take." He said, "The details of this are so severe, I handle this all day, I'm having a hard time believing the story, it's too horrific." I will spare you the details, both for your own upset as well as the confidentiality of the patient, but he was abused by multiple people in various settings over a prolonged period of time. Yanki was 4 years old at the time. He intersected with a number of paraprofessionals who believed that you don't go to therapists right away, they make a big deal about these things, they get carried away. So they tried various avenues to help this child, make it all go away. Those failed miserably. By the time I got that call, this child had every single symptom of trauma one can imagine. Night terrors, flashbacks, fear of going to school, angry outbursts, wetting himself in school to the point that his overwhelming fear, he defecated on himself in school. When the parents finally came to me, they were in tatters, believing that they had lost their child forever. It took a great deal of effort to even establish basic safety for this child in my office, for him to even be able to play some sort of safe space. But I saw that with time, I can slowly access this child. But I realized if I really wanted this child to get better, a lot of things in the home had to change. The parents came from a very different world, very Hasidic world, where patching was something that the father took pride in, where the mother's sisters ran homes that looked like military bases. So the ideas of creating a very sensitive, empathic, understanding environment at home, to look away from the child's outburst and his chutzpah and his making a mess and his even hitting his siblings, and to focus on why he does the things and to focus much more on his feelings than on his behavior, was a radical departure for them. And it was literally a slugfest. I was accused of being a Madernish. Madernish was good. I was accused of being a goy. I was accused of liberal ideas and going connected to Torah. It was long and a brutal battle. But I was doing it for one reason and one reason only, for the sake of this family. And eventually, slowly, the mother really started to get it. And she started being more sensitive to this child, more empathic towards him, trying to look away from his behavior and look into his guts. The father backed off. He wasn't ready to take on her approach yet, but he stopped doing such direct hazard. Slowly things started to change. The parents had a tremendous amount of their own vicarious trauma. I had to refer the mother to a colleague of mine, and eventually they went in for marriage therapy. Slowly but surely, the entire system started to change. The kid was really coming back to himself. One of the most amazing feelings you could ever have is when you see the lights go back on inside a person. The lights went back on, and even more so the parents started to get on board. But the mother really struggled with, why should I give this kid so much more than the other kids? My sister's kids, look at them. Is this really the right thing to do? And in one of my attempts at helping them continue with this approach, I called upon a paper I had read years before that talked about greenhouse parenting. And it gave a mushroom that some children are like weeds. Weeds, more water, more sunlight, less sunlight. They pop up, they even pop up where you don't want them to pop up. They're able to go, they're very hardy, they're very resilient. But some flowers, like the orchid, need greenhouse parenting. They need a highly sensitive environment, temperature, sunlight, water, nutrients. But with that greenhouse parenting, those children will thrive. So things went on. The father actually went to his own therapy, finally acknowledging his perfectionism. Things really changed. The mother says that really she should call me every single day, because through the most traumatic incident imaginable, she now has a better relationship with her children and her husband than ever thought possible before this occurred. And had she not been exposed to any of these ideas, she would have been stagnant in so many other areas. And now she's incredibly close with her sons and her daughters, and the husband and wife relationship is completely different. So the final day of me seeing this boy, he comes in with an orchid. I'm in tears. The mother's in tears. The kid is smiling from ear to ear. He's living a happy, healthy life. He doesn't know anything about the orchid story, but it's his parting gift to me. And the mother says to me, there are a lot of turning points in our work. But he said, sometime, and I was really struggling, and I was almost there, but I couldn't go over that step. The fact that my son can turn out to be one of those orchids helped me push through. And so I wanted you to have this. So I took this orchid home, and I was going to give it the most amazing greenhouse ever. I bring this home, and I'm watering it. My wife's watering it. And the thing starts to smell. It's smelling really weird. The blossoms are okay. I'm getting into an argument with my wife. I say this thing is dying. She says she actually thinks it's growing. We're having a crisis. This is going on for a couple weeks, and there's a really foul odor coming out of this orchid, and I can't get rid of it. Finally, my sister comes for a visit. She goes up to the orchid. She's sniffing the orchid. She's staring at the orchid. She's examining the orchid. And finally, she turns to me, and she says, you know it's fake, right? My wife and I are incredulous. The rubber or whatever it was held did not take well to the water. So we got rid of the water, and this orchid sits in my dining room. And when I look at this orchid, there are three crucial take-homes that I get from it whenever I look at it. One is, sometimes our best efforts, what we do with our whole hearts, mesiras nefesh, they can really be negative if we misread what's going on by the child. We're putting in our own stuff to push them, to develop them, but it's coming from us. It's not what they actually need. Number two, if we gave a lot more of our kids greenhouse parenting, there would be no need for child psychologists. There would be no need for Amuvim. Tzvi and I would find something else to do. And lastly, but maybe most importantly, and I don't know how Rabbi Wallerstein, so it must be something from Shemayim. Sometimes, when all looks bleak, this kid had enough trauma that he shot the person from relief who handles trauma calls all day. One of the most egregious acts of abuse that I've ever been a part of treating. So it looks bleak. It's in the earth. It's underground.
But what's there? Seeds. And no matter what they've been through, if we refuse to give up on them, if we have the people who will stand by them, if we act as those eagles, they'll grow into beautiful orchids. And I hope, for me it's much more poignant, but for you, when you walk out and you'll see some flowers blossoming in the spring, and we're coming upon Shavuos, and in this neighborhood we have an orchid set, that maybe you'll remember these three lessons from the orchid story. Because if we dig deep, we're self-compassionate, we're empathic, and we provide that greenhouse, Hashem is going to look upon us and say, you are the eagles, and I will be your eagles, and it'll take us to our final destination. Shiach Tzidkenu, Heir Yemeinu, Amen. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much, Dr. Zimmerman, Bevelyan Whitney, and Rabbi Zachariah Wallerstein. I'm gonna make this very brief. I started off the evening giving you a number that's a factual number, and it's probably larger than the number that I mentioned, because that's just what I know about, which is 66 neshamas will never have a chance to grow families since this Rosh Hashanah. And people always ask me, if that's true and that's what I see at work, what's the drive to go the next day? Why are we still fighting this battle if we are looking at something on the negative side of it? And the truth is, I ask myself that question many times as well. But then I look at the positive, and I look at how the world has changed. It was about 15 years ago that I was asked to speak the first time in a public setting about the magefa of sexual abuse in our front community. And I look now at the last 15 years, and I look at how our community as a whole has changed. It was closer to 20 years ago that I started dealing with issues pertaining to addiction. And I use the following example for myself, and this is the message that I want to give over, and hopefully we can take from here. 35 years ago, if a family had somebody that was born with a developmental disability, the family tried to hide it. It would hurt the magic word shidduchim for other kids. And then amazing organizations came out and started helping with that, and it became an issue that was embraced, and now we have Shabbaton and Yachad and all the amazing work that gets done, and to make people that are born with special needs part of our society and part of our culture and part of our families. And then it was the machla. God forbid anyone can say the word cancer. It was the machla. We did talk about it. And it took us years to come over that step as well. And between organizations such as Chai Lifeline, RCCS, Kids of Courage, and so many other wonderful organizations, tackled that issue. Then it was the kids at risk nobody could talk about. And that took time to develop, whether it's Our Place, Madrigos, Priority One, and so many other wonderful institutions that have developed to work for that field. And we decided to take the bold step when it came to child sexual abuse within the community. And we're seeing a tremendous change for the positive. Yes, we're nowhere near where I think we should be, but we are light years ahead of where we were when I first got involved and when Dr. Zimmerman first got involved and so many others here. The main thing is people have to realize there are resources available. There is help available. There are people out there that want to help to make sure that people that are suffering don't have to suffer. My wife likes to say the following mashal. She's actually works for Rabbi Wallerstein in the high school in BCA. We just had a Shabbaton this week for the school as well, separate from his. And my wife likes to say the following mashal, I'll make it short, where she talks about someone who gets stuck in a ditch. And different people come by and they ask for help, and there's the clergy member that comes by and says, oh, I'll pray for you and God will make a miracle and you'll come out. And the architect comes by and says, oh, I'll come up with some plan to build something, it'll take some time, we'll get you out of the ditch. And then the person's friend comes by and without thinking jumps into the ditch. And the person looks and goes, Shaita, what are you doing? Now we're both stuck. Says, you're right, but two is better than one, and together we'll overcome this obstacle. At the end of the day, Klal Yisrael, as a nation, we love to help each other in whatever way we can. And the main thing is people have to know there is help available. There are plenty of amazing organizations out there. There are Askanim, Rabbanim, therapists. People just need to feel comfortable to say, we need the help. We want to get to the next step. We don't want to live, as Dr. Zimmerman said, alone, in shame. We need to be able to address that and get to the next level and help the person next to us and not walk past them and look down at somebody because they're suffering. But look at that person and say, how can I help make your life better? And I say this all the time, and I'm going to say it again now. People walk down the street and they see that kid that's the odd one out, who's no longer wearing the yarmulke, and people are talking about him. Instead of walking by that child and looking at him, what about walking by and saying, hey, how about a slice of pizza? Can I get you a cup of coffee? How was your day? Showing someone that you care, this is not rocket science. It's really being able to take from ourselves and give it to somebody else. This is the message that I like to leave off with. We are all in this together. We are all part of this great nation. And we all have the same Father that cares for us and loves us and has protected us. And we have our trials and tribulations in every generation. I mean, as I was just looking up, I saw the memorial for the 6 million Kedoshim. I can't imagine what that was like. I don't even want to try. With my visits to concentration camps and grandparents telling me stories, every generation we have in Israel is that we don't know how to overcome it. We don't always know if we have the answers, but somehow we prevail. That's because people try and fight for it. And we have right now an epidemic between drug addiction, sexual abuse, and mental illness that has not been seen before in our communities, or at least not documented to the level that we see now. What's going to separate us is how we respond to that. And I say this wholeheartedly. I daven for the day that myself and Shlomo Zimmerman can go look for other work. I would love nothing more than to not be busy with this Yom V'Laila. But unfortunately, as long as there's problems, we're going to do our best. And we have to just daven that the Eibishter will help us get through this, as we have with all the other trials and tribulations. And in this chus, we should all see nachas from our own families, and only be zecher to pure, real simcha, and to be able to welcome Pnei Mashiach. Amen. I would like to take one moment and really just thank those that really made this event happen from start to finish. Rabbi Avi Feldman, who really put his kaifas into this. I'd like to give him a round of applause, please. And Michal Geiger, I don't know where you're hiding someplace, but around the corner as well. And to all the other amazing staff at Amudim and all of our partners in Chazak and our wonderful speakers and the yeshivas and schools here, thank you very, very much for coming.